From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
The problem with Mr. Price is, you know, he actually throws everybody he can find into this grab bag of groups and organizations and people who he claims support militant Islam, including people who are not interested in religion at all, like me. So what he's engaging in is a concerted campaign of character assassination aimed at any prominent Arab-American or American-Muslim organization or spokesperson. He does it completely without regard for the truth. Now,
he has been called one of the country's leading Islamophobes. He claims up to 15% of Muslims are, quote, potential killers. He's Daniel Pipes, and he's been nominated by President Bush to serve on the United States Institute of Peace, despite protests of Muslim Americans. As we tried to talk to him, he hung up twice.
I'm going to have to get off this phone because now for the second time I made it clear that I can only talk with a host. I'm not engaged in a debate with someone who has come out against my nomination.
But we also will speak with anti-nuclear activist Helen Caldicott and go to Baghdad to talk to Christian Science Monitor reporter Scott Peterson. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. U.S. military officials have told the New York Times that the Pentagon intends to maintain four bases in Iraq even after occupation forces leave. The Pentagon may maintain full occupational bases in Iraq or just access to the bases in times of crisis. Officials claim this does not contradict the administration's official policy of rapid withdrawal from Iraq. The bases would pose a significant threat to neighboring Syria, and Iran would be sandwiched between U.S. bases in Iraq and Afghanistan. The past 2 years have seen a rapid expansion of U.S. military bases across thousands of miles, stretching from the Balkans to the Chinese border and taking in the Caucasus, Central Asia, the Middle East, and the Indian subcontinent. The New York Times calls it a swath of Western influence not seen for generations. A former Iraqi scientist has told a U.S. military team that Iraq destroyed chemical weapons and biological warfare equipment only days before the U.S. invasion. This according to an article in the New York Times by Judith Miller. The scientist also says Iraq secretly sent unconventional weapons and technology to Syria starting in the mid-90s and that more recently Iraq was cooperating with al-Qaeda. And he led Americans to material that proved to be the building blocks for a toxic agent that is banned by chemical weapons treaties. U.S. officials said it's the most important discovery to date in the hunt for illegal weapons. The Pentagon's refusing to identify the toxic agent or the name of the scientist. Reporter Judith Miller is embedded with the U.S. military and said she was not allowed to write about the scientist for 3 days. Her report was submitted to military officials for censorship. New York Times article comes as British Prime Minister Tony Blair is facing increasing demands for an investigation into whether British intelligence services misled the government into believing Saddam Hussein was harboring weapons of mass destruction. Conservatives said yesterday Tony Blair has a moral obligation to investigate the issue. The British defense minister rejected the call and said it might take a long time to find any weapons. Britain is now suggesting that an independent country should confirm any discovery of weapons by British or U.S. troops. The New York Times reported on Saturday the Bush administration is planning to ask the United Nations to lift sanctions against Iraq in phases. The UN would maintain its supervision of Iraqi oil sales for now. This comes after Russia, France, and other Security Council members made it clear they will not support the lifting of sanctions unless the United Nations is given a central role in the rebuilding of Iraq. The Times also reported some Bush administration officials fear a messy situation in which the U.S. or U.S.-occupied Iraq could be sued for selling oil in defiance of U.N. measures and in violation of international law. This appears to be the first evidence that the Bush administration had been considering selling Iraqi oil illegally before the sanctions are lifted. Also Saturday, the foreign ministers from the countries that share a border with Iraq met in Saudi Arabia for their first post-invasion summit meeting. They all agreed to oppose the lifting of UN sanctions until a legitimate government in Iraq, formed by Iraqis, is in place. They said the U.S. has no right to exploit Iraq's oil and should pull out as soon as possible, and they called for a central post-invasion role for the United Nations. The Bush administration's temporary ruler of Iraq, retired U.S. General Jay Garner, has arrived in Baghdad as confusion mounts over who's in control of the Iraqi capital. The U.S. coordinator for Central Iraq, Barbara Bodine, the ambassador to Yemen, said today that Washington does not recognize Mohammed Mohsen al-Zubaydi as the mayor of Baghdad. Al-Zubaydi is a longtime exile and deputy leader of the U.S.-backed Iraqi National Congress. Late last week, he announced he had been elected mayor of Baghdad to the surprise of most residents. Bodine's comments come after al-Zubaydi's deputy, Jawdat al-Obaidi, announced he will lead an Iraqi delegation to a meeting of OPEC, the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries, starting on Thursday in Vienna. And the Financial Times reports the Iraqi oil ministry, ringed by U.S. tanks and guarded by U.S. soldiers, was paid a visit by a representative of al-Zubaydi. He said he represented the new coordinating committee for the oil ministry. Less than 2 weeks after Saddam's government fell, thousands of his Ba'ath Party members are resuming their roles as the men and women who run Iraq, this according to the London Guardian. It's become increasingly apparent that Washington cannot restore governance to Baghdad without resorting to the party, which for decades controlled every aspect of life under the Iraqi regime. 2,000 policemen, all card-holding party members, have put on their uniforms and returned to the streets of Baghdad at the U.S. invitation. Dozens of minders from the Information Ministry, who spied on foreign journalists for the security agencies, have returned to the Palestine Hotel, where most reporters stay, offering their services as translators to unwitting new arrivals. Meanwhile, the Pentagon-backed Iraqi exile, Ahmed Chalabi, has called for U.S. troops to remain in Iraq until democratic elections can be held, which he said could take 2 years. And Senator Richard Lugar of Indiana, the Republican chair of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, said yesterday it could take at least 5 years to create a functioning democracy in Iraq. Two senior figures in the ousted Iraqi regime were captured at the weekend, including Saddam Hussein's son-in-law and one of his trusted inner circle, Jamal Mustafa Sultan Abdullah al-Tikriti. According to the Iraqi National Congress, Jamal Mustafa left Syria, where he had fled, and surrendered to the INC in Baghdad. This news from China: the mayor of Beijing has been fired as China's acknowledging over 100 other cases of the deadly SARS virus, including 4 in provinces previously thought free of the disease. The AFP reports the Minister of Health will likely be sacked as well. Singapore's prime minister estimates SARS has already cost the country over $800 million. The World Health Organization and the U.S. Centers for Disease Control have advised all non-essential travel to Hong Kong, China, Singapore, and Hanoi be postponed, and several U.S. companies are restricting employee travel to the Far East. In the United States, health officials are investigating at least 193 cases in 32 states, including 5 in Virginia. The New York Times reports that scientists applying for federal grants to study AIDS are being told to cleanse their applications of politically sensitive words that refer to same-sex partnering or drug use. Speaking on condition of anonymity, an official at the National Institute of Health said that while researchers had always been advised to avoid phrases that might be controversial, the level of scrutiny under the Bush administration is, quote, much worse and more intense. An Israeli soldier shot and killed an Associated Press cameraman in the West Bank city of Nablus on Saturday. 45-year-old Naza Darwaza was filming a skirmish between Israeli troops firing on rock-throwing Palestinians. Then, as Israeli soldier pointed his gun at the journalists and fired, Darwaza was shot in the head. He and the other cameramen covering the melee wore brightly colored vests that said press in bold letters. Darwaza is the fourth journalist killed covering the Israel-Palestine conflict in the past year. All four were shot by Israeli soldiers. And the U.S. Army ignored warnings from its own civilian advisors that could have prevented the looting of Baghdad's National Museum. This, according to leaked documents seen by the London Observer. The Office of Reconstruction and Humanitarian Assistance, set up to supervise the reconstruction of post-invasion Iraq, identified Iraq's National Museum as a prime target for looters in a memo to Army commanders a month ago. The memo said it should be the second priority for the Army after securing the National Bank. The leader of the Office of Reconstruction and Humanitarian Assistance, General Jay Garner, is said to be livid. One angry OHRA official told the Observer, quote, "We asked for just a few soldiers at each building, or if they feared snipers, just one or two tanks. The tanks were doing nothing once they got inside the city, yet the generals refused to deploy them." The late Tito Puente, he would have been 80 years old yesterday. You are listening to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman as we go directly to Baghdad to Scott Peterson, reporter for the Christian Science Monitor. Welcome, Scott.
Thank you.
I know you're on deadline and on your satellite phone, so thanks for joining us. Can you tell us the latest in Baghdad with Jay Garner, the retired American general, now arrived there?
Well, I think that Mr. Garner is having a bit of an eye-opener of a trip at the moment. I think he's seeing firsthand what the extent of some of the looting has been, some of the damage that's been done separate from the war and in the aftermath of the war. But he's also vowing that that electricity and water will be restored as soon as it can be, he says, and also is hearing from doctors and others this morning that they are grateful that the United States has liberated them, in their words, from Saddam Hussein. So he's hearing a lot here, I think, on this four-day visit. It's a short one, of course, but one in which he will have at least firsthand a view of what some of the problems are.
We've just been reporting on the self-proclaimed mayor of Baghdad and Mohammed Mohsen al-Zubaydi. And the U.S. coordinator for Central Iraq, the ambassador to Yemen, Barbara Boudin, saying the U.S. will not recognize him, who has announced that they are also sending, he as the self-proclaimed mayor is sending, will lead an Iraqi delegation to a meeting of OPEC.
Well, I think that this, self-declared mayor is really the operating word. A colleague of mine just met him and came back and reported that he was a double zero. I heard from the International Committee of the Red Cross yesterday that as far as they were concerned, that this self-declared mayor had actually lost his job 2 days ago. So I think his status is up in the air, and I would imagine that Barbara Bodine would want to keep her distance from him. I don't think he's got much of a power base in Baghdad at all. People don't know who he is, and it sounds like from the response so far, certainly from those who've been close to him, that he's not likely to go too far in the toing and froing of post-war politics in Iraq.
Scott Peterson, you wrote that the U.S. Army will be establishing a central point for compensation claims, the headline of your Christian Science Monitor piece, Setbacks in Winning Iraqi Hearts. Can you explain?
Well, there have been cases in which Iraqis have grievances in the sense that there have either been, in their views, unjustified killings of civilians, and so family members are looking for compensation and apologies. There have also been cases in which that I explored quite in detail, in which American forces were responsible, in this case, accidental destruction of several houses in a neighborhood. So those are the kind of things that we would expect to see Iraqis making claims for in compensation. The U.S. military has a claims network, which they are beginning to establish here. We've seen them do that in Somalia, Kosovo, and Bosnia. And basically, it's an effort besides doing the legal thing. It's also one in which, if compensation is permitted, it's certainly something that is uncommon in the Middle East, and so people don't expect that any military or occupying forces, would admit that things, that they were responsible for any kind of problem and pay compensation. So in that sense, this is kind of a surprising bonus for people when something bad has happened either to them or to their family, and it really does go away toward winning hearts and minds.
You've also been speaking with Iraqi soldiers, and in one of your pieces, you wrote about three tales of shock and defeat.
Well, there are thousands of stories of how this war was conducted and what happened to Iraqi officers and soldiers as American forces moved north from Kuwait. The several that I spoke to describe instances in which, for example, there were forces that had been backed by Iran, in fact, that had come across the border. These are Iraqi exile forces, and that they had actually done some of the fighting against the Iraqi military and forced the Iraqi military out of certain positions. Quite dramatic, but basically it wasn't American forces that forced the Iraqis out of the southern town of Amara. That's one case. In another case, I spoke to a brigadier who basically made clear that from his perspective, this was a regular army brigadier, that Iraq had no plans at any time or at any point to use chemical weapons, that was something that had been overly dramatized in the media and really wasn't a factor as far as he was concerned. The types of material that has been found in the south in terms of gas masks and that sort of thing, he said, really was simply prudent issues of these kind of gear to any army. I mean, the United States Army has that, the Iraqi Army has that, and, most armies have some kind of chemical and biological weapons protection. So that's what he said, which is quite interesting because, of course, one of the primary reasons for launching this war was because of the fear of Iraqi chemical and biological weapons.
Can you talk about what Iraqi Army Major Saleh Abdullah Mahdi al-Jabouri remembers about the beginning of the invasion, and also if you could talk about what you know of Iraqi casualties?
Well, I think that in terms of Iraqi casualties, I mean, the Iraqis themselves up until pretty much a week or two before the end of the war were keeping their figures quite conservative and very specific. So, there have been a lot of casualties, there's no question, but when I say a lot, I mean, we're talking about probably several thousand, as opposed to several tens of thousands or several hundreds of thousands, which had been forecast before this war began. American casualties also have been quite low. But what these officers are really commenting on and what they're griping about is how their defense was handled by Saddam Hussein and by the ruling family. And what they really complain about is that these irregular forces, especially the Fedayeen and others who often would launch an attack and expect a reward, simply didn't have the kind of staying power that regular army forces would have. And so they were quite disappointed that in many cases the regular army units weren't involved in the fighting or ordered into the fight, that basically it was these militia units that were being used to mount the resistance in the south. And when push came to shove, the American troops were in Baghdad before the regular army could even had a chance to fight.
Jabouri saying the day that the invasion began, describing that for himself.
Well, the way that the war began for a lot of these guys is that those who were in Baghdad especially had tried to separate their command. They'd left the Ministry of Defense buildings and basically had come up with a plan to hire different houses throughout Baghdad and kind of break apart their command structure. And in fact, one of the most interesting things that I heard was that they were using, for the entire first 2 weeks of the war, they were actually using the everyday Iraqi telephone system in order to send out their commands and order their troops around, because they didn't want to use anything that was high frequency. They didn't want to use radios. They didn't want to use any other means of contact. And so they actually used regular telephone lines.
Have you spent any time in Baghdad hospitals recently, Scott?
Well, an interesting thing in the Baghdad hospitals now is that several of them are being taken over by Shiite Muslim clerics, and they are kind of running the show, and that is part of a broader agenda by Shias in Baghdad to institute some kind of control over daily life. They saw a power vacuum there. The United States has hardly come forward yet to fill that power vacuum, and so in the gap, you've got quite a few Shia clerics who not only have taken over control of some hospitals, but they have also been at the forefront of insisting that looters bring back equipment that was stolen and bring them to mosques and that kind of thing. So in one respect, it's quite positive in that there has been a new sense of order instilled at some of these places, their armed guards placed at the gate of hospitals, etc. But on the other hand, it also poses quite a challenge to the authority of American forces here.
And any word on the looting of the museum? In the last week, we have heard about the forklifts having moved in, some of those who plundered it having keys to vaults, and then one of the Tark Mesopotamian archaeologists in the United States at University of Chicago saying he believes if there's any kind of investigation, it will show that this was orchestrated from outside of Iraq, the plundering of the National Museum.
Right, and if that is true, then it's unlikely that some of those pieces are going to ever be returned. I know that the FBI is sending a team over here to begin dealing with it and putting it together. But my understanding also was that the National Museum was one of the top priorities on the list of American targets to protect, and that the oil ministry was down quite low on the list, down at apparently number 16 on the list, while the museum was number one. If this is true, it's quite interesting because the museum really was left unprotected and therefore got completely ransacked, while the oil ministry was one of the very few government facilities that from the first moment had a cordon of American troops around it. So it still remains intact.
Well, Scott Peterson, thanks very much for being with us of the Christian Science Monitor reporting from Baghdad. You are listening to Democracy Now! When we come back, we're going to talk about an early CIA plot that Saddam Hussein was a key part of and how the Central Intelligence Agency supported him over the decades.
سعیده گل ستای شده
You are listening to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Looking at a piece that was put out by United Press International, written by Richard Sale, the intelligence correspondent, it says U.S. forces in Baghdad might now be searching high and low for Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein. But in the past, Saddam was seen by U.S. intelligence services as a bulwark of anti-communism, and they used him as their instrument for more than 40 years. This, according to former U.S. intelligence diplomats and intelligence officials. United Press International has interviewed almost a dozen former U.S. diplomats, British scholars, and former U.S. intelligence officials to piece together the following account. The CIA declined to comment on the report, and the UPI report goes on to say, while many have thought that Saddam first became involved with U.S. intelligence agencies at the start of the September 1980 Iran-Iraq War, his first contacts with U.S. officials date back to 1959, when he was part of a CIA-authorized six-man squad tasked with assassinating the then Iraqi prime minister. But let's let Richard Sale tell the story, the UPI reporter who broke this story. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Richard Sale.
Yes, good morning.
Well, why don't you just go back in time and recount the history that you have unearthed through your interviews with various diplomats, scholars, and former U.S. intelligence officials?
Well, I think that we have to go back to the time where U.S. policy had a tendency to judge everything in terms of its being anti-communist. Its value consisted mainly in that. And at the time, Iraq was viewed as a key buffer and a strategic asset in the Cold War. And it was a member of the Baghdad Pact, and it was the other members of that pact were Turkey, Britain, Pakistan, and Iran. And the United States was very much interested in dealing with the people who commanded single groups. We believed at that time that multi-party systems brought confusion, and a system in Iraq where you had, a lot of democracy would be very detrimental to us. The crisis came when Prime Minister Gassem moved very close to the Soviet Union. As a matter of fact, he put four of his four pro-communists in his ministries. And that really prompted the CIA to action, especially after he'd withdrawn from the Baghdad Pact. So they put this team together, and they attempted to get rid of Gassem. Gassem was simply too risky. He was a flaming radical.
And so how did they do it?
Well, they put together it was supposed to be carried out on October 7th, 1959, and there was a six-man team. And Saddam was I think he was 22 years old at that time, and he had committed two murders already. They were going to murder Gassem. First, the agency and the Egyptian intelligence installed Hussein across in an apartment across the street from the Ministry of Defense, so Saddam and the team could observe Gassem's movements. And then they sent the team out. I think it turned into a farce because Saddam got nervous and I think opened fire too soon, and he killed the driver of Gassem's car. Gassem then hit on the floor of the car, and the whole thing went awry. But there was one assassin who didn't have bullets that fit his gun. There was another whose hand grenade got stuck in the lining of his coat. It was really kind of a low comedy. And so after that, Saddam simply turned, his mother's picture to the wall and fled. You know, he went into Syria.
And didn't Saddam Hussein himself get grazed by a bullet from one of the other assassins?
Yeah, he later said, of course, that he'd had this horrible wound and had been very stoical while a doctor probed it, and it became part of his legend. But that's exactly where it remains. It was, in fact, a graze from one of his own men, and it hardly broke the skin.
His handler, his CIA handler?
No, it was just a fellow assassin.
Right, but who was his CIA handler?
I'm not sure of the name of the gentleman. Mm-hmm. He had a team of them. Once he got into Syria, he was transferred by Egyptian intelligence agencies to Beirut. And while he was in Beirut, the agency put him into an apartment there, and they paid for that, and then they put him through a short training course. And then he was forwarded on to Cairo. At that time, the U.S. was very much attempting to build, believe it or not, a single-party system to keep Nasser out of the clutches of the communists. And so Saddam stayed in a very poor part of Cairo for a certain number of years, spending his time playing dominoes.
You quote a former U.S. government official who knew Saddam at the time, saying that even then, Saddam, quote, was known as having no class. He was a thug, a cutthroat.
Yes. He was a worker bee, as somebody else said. He did not exhibit a great deal of political potential. Nobody knew much about him, except that he was willing to, you know, carry out tasks, you know, the blood work for the United States.
So there he was in Cairo, watched over by CIA and Egyptian intelligence operatives. What happened to him next?
Well, then he returned to Iraq in February of 1963. And Gassam was killed in a coup. The CIA, there are some U.S. officials that say the U.S. was behind this. The majority of intelligence officials I talked to said we were not, and we were utterly surprised by it. It had really been done in secret, but we immediately took advantage of it. And what the agency did was to hand out to the Ba'ath Party under Saddam, they gave lists to Iraqi National Guardsmen of communists, and the communists were sometimes jailed, sometimes interrogated, but most often they were simply executed outright.
We're talking to Richard Sale, had an exclusive story for UPI, United Press International, Saddam Key, an early CIA plot. So Saddam has moved to Egypt. He's handled by CIA and Egyptian intelligence operatives, making frequent visits to the American embassy, where CIA specialists such as Miles Copeland and CIA station chief Jim Eichelberger were in residence and knew Saddam. You speak to a lot of people who don't want to go on the record, it seems.
Yes.
Why?
Well, I believe their pensions are at stake. The CIA has very clear and stringent rules that I think even reach to their to the next generation. They signed an agreement that they will not talk about these operations because many of them, everything I'm sure that I wrote about, it was is still classified.
Mm-hmm. You talked to Roger Morris, the former State Department Foreign Service officer. There's also a follow-up piece by Reuters that's swirling around the internet right now.
Right.
Ex-U.S. official says CIA aided Ba'athists. You also spoke to him. What did he say about?
I did not speak to Roger. I tried to reach him in Seattle, but I quoted from his piece. And his piece, to me, had some errors in it, but it was interesting, and I believed it to be true because, as I say, Miles Copeland, who was a mentor of mine, actually, who really taught me a lot about the way U.S. policy acts on the ground in the Middle East, he had told me that the agency enjoyed ties with the Ba'athists and that he knew Saddam.
And claims that recently that the CIA was behind the coup, which was sanctioned by President John Kennedy.
We were doing a lot of nation building. I think Miles himself had practically single-handedly destabilized the government of Syria in 1949, a thing of which he was very proud. And we had certainly aided Nasser in getting him on his feet in Egypt after he got rid of the British puppet Farouk. And the United States was thinking then in really sort of really strange ways, and I think that they're worth noting. Miles and his group went into Egypt to make sure that Saddam that Nasser did not have a multi-party system. They worked very hard to set up a single party system because they felt that where the Iraqis they wanted a system where the Iraqis would be free. The Egyptians would be free to vote without allowing much scope for argument about what would be voted on. And they felt that if you had a multi-party system, you would just end with parties that were supported by America or the French or whatever. And you just wonder how much of this thought is being applied to Iraq today.
You know, the description of what happened with Qasem being killed and the Ba'ath Party coup in 1963 sounds so similar to what was happening right about the same time in Indonesia when the U.S. CIA backed Suharto and then gave him the lists of dissidents, the Communist Party, and would check off the names as Suharto's men assassinated them. You've got the same description for Iraq in 1963.
Roger Morris makes that point very clearly in his piece. And the other thing is, I would say it is very similar to the way that Ayatollah Khomeini in Iran, after he got to power, when he first returned to power, he was cooperating very closely with the United States. We had decided on a policy that we wanted to pick a leader who generally represented the broadest the spectrum of national aspirations, and Khomeini was clearly that. And when he got into power, all of a sudden, Iran had like 4,000 communists, and they were the first people that Khomeini executed. And it seems it's eerily strange, as you say, reminiscent of Indonesia and of Qasem.
And, of course, then you have 10 years before. This is the 50th anniversary of the Shah coming to power in Iran with the support of the U.S. CIA, specifically Kermit Roosevelt, the grandson of Teddy Roosevelt.
Well, the CIA also supported the rise of Mossadegh in Iraq to help break up the British oil consortium. And that is rarely ever reported. Everybody talks about the CIA taking Mossadegh out of power, but and it's rarely mentioned that the CIA helped to put him in. It was done, and again, on the basis of the same reasoning I just conveyed, that you know, you needed to back a figure who that most genuinely embodied the national aspirations.
Richard Sale, let's move on with Saddam. After the Ba'athist coup and the killing of the Iraqi leader, what happened to Saddam Hussein?
Well, he was involved in another CIA-backed coup in 1968, which brought the Ba'ath Party back to power. We stuck with him at the time of the beginning of the summer before the Iran-Iraq War of 1980. There were Pentagon officials who were sending Saddam Hussein doctored intelligence, urging him to attack Iran, and urging him that there would be internal uprisings and the country would fall in 3 days. And some of those gentlemen are now very senior in the Pentagon, but they were sources of mine at the time, and told me the various couriers and ex-Irani running prime ministers and generals that they were using as couriers to get this doctored intelligence to Saddam. Of course, he swallowed it all and went in and got admired in this horrible war.
Mm-hmm. The CIA, DIA, Defense Intelligence Agency, giving both the coordinates from Saudi AWACS surveillance aircraft, you report, to aid Saddam Hussein as well as Iran, giving it to both sides.
Yes. We were very much interested in a stalemate, just the same way that Hitler wanted no winner in the Spanish War. He used that war to really realign his diplomatic relations with Italy. But we did not want a winner in the Iran-Iraq War. We wanted Iran and Iraq basically bled dry. They were the most aggressive countries in the region, and they posed the most danger to U.S. interests and to their neighbors.
Well, Richard Sale, I want to thank you very much for being with us. Exclusive report in United Press International, Saddam key in early CIA plot. Finally, you report that the U.S. Intelligence Alliance of Convenience came to an end August 2, 1990, when 100,000 Iraqi troops, backed by 300 tanks, invaded Kuwait. You're listening to Democracy Now! When we come back, a very interesting discussion. You can hear Richard Pearl, you can hear rather Mr. Pipes, who has been nominated by President Bush to the Institute of Peace, hang up twice. Stay with us.
¿Qué ha pasado? Tú una falta de respeto. ¿Cómo le van a robar los timbales al mi rey? Al rey Tito Puente. Le voy a preguntar a Caco. Le robaron los timbales a Tito.
Le robaron los timbales a Tito.
También le voy a preguntar a Willy Bobo.
Le robaron los timbales a Tito.
A Enta el dueño, a Willy Rosario.
Tito Puente, who would have been 80 years old yesterday. You're listening to Democracy Now!, breaking the sound barrier. This is the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. He's been called the country's leading Islamophobe. He claims up to 15% of Muslims are potential killers. He says Muslim government police officers, soldiers, and diplomats, quote, need to be watched for connections to terrorism. And he contends that, quote, mosques require a scrutiny beyond that applied to churches and temples. His name is Daniel Pipes. He's founder of the Middle East Forum and a columnist for the New York Post. He's now been nominated by President Bush to serve on the U.S. Institute of Peace. Muslim groups have protested Bush's selection. Now the Washington Post has called on Bush to rescind the nomination. So far, Pipes has generally refused to discuss that nomination. Last week, he walked off the set of an Al Jazeera news show when he learned representatives from the Council of American Islamic Relations would also appear on the show. Well, almost 2 weeks ago, we talked with Daniel Pipes, as well as Hussein Ibish of the American Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee and Ibrahim Cooper of the Council on American Islamic Relations. Since it was a phone interview, Pipes couldn't walk off the set, but he did the next closest thing. He hung up, not once, but twice, but we were able to ask him a few questions. This happened as we were watching the U.S. troops pull the statue of Saddam Hussein down in Baghdad. But I began by asking Daniel Pipes for his response to the charge that he's the nation's leading Islamophobe.
I make a distinction between militant Islam and moderate Islam. I say that militant Islam is the problem, and moderate Islam is the solution. I also say that CARE and its affiliates are part of the problem. These are militant Islamic groups. These are, in effect, the allies and apologists for people like bin Laden who are operating in Washington. So, naturally, they're not terribly enthusiastic about my analysis. But there are essentially three viewpoints in this country at this point on who the enemy is. You have the official version, that it's terrorists. You have the argument that's primarily promoted by evangelical spokesmen and analysts that it is Muslims. And then you have me in between those two saying that it's neither terrorism nor is it Islam, but it's a terroristic version of Islam, or what I call militant Islam.
Well, we're also joined by Hussein Ibish of the American Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee, who has raised concerns about your nomination. Hussein Ibish, can you respond?
Yeah, well, first of all, I mean, one of the people that Mr. Pipes has accused of being a militant Islamist, and he did this in print, and it was repeated in a number of newspapers, and he's, he had made this point many times, is me. And not only am I not a militant Islamist, I'm an agnostic. I'm a secularist. I work for a secular organization. The problem with Mr. Price is, you know, he actually throws everybody he can find into this grab bag of groups and organizations and people who he claims support militant Islam, including people who are not interested in religion at all, like me. So what he's engaging in is a concerted campaign of character assassination aimed at any prominent Arab-American or American-Muslim organization or spokesperson. He does it completely without regard for the truth. Now, when I made it clear that I could not be accused of being a militant Muslim, he switched and called me a radical leftist. You know, so if I couldn't be an extreme right-winger, I had to be an extreme left-winger. It's all part of his campaign of vilification and personal defamation. Additionally, though, I think what's important is that Mr. Pipes, who's entitled to his views, shouldn't be on any Commission for Peace or Institute of Peace, because he's in favor of war. All you need to do is read his articles regarding the Israeli-Palestinian conflict and see how he has demanded an Israeli, quote, victory, close quote, that in fact he writes that Palestinians need to be defeated by Israel as much as Israel needs to defeat them.
We're talking to Hussein Ibish of the American Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee, and we're trying to convince Daniel Pipes to come back on the telephone. He has hung up the phone.
He hung up. I was telling my colleagues here that he was going to do that as soon as we started talking, because he can dish it out. You know, he's called me every name in the book. He wrote a 900-word essay about why I'm a jerk and demanded I be thrown off television, called me immoral, inaccurate, anti-Semitic, and anti-American, if you please. But he can't take it. I've really done is just describe to you the substance of his work, and he can't stand that. Yeah. Probably his only really well-known book is a book called The Paranoid Style, How Conspiracy Theory Flourishes, and he sort of condemns the prevalence of conspiracy theories in the Middle East among Arabs and Muslims. And, you know, that is a very rich and interesting topic that I've also talked a lot about, and certainly I know conspiratorial thinking is very ripe in that part of the world. We have it here, too. But one of the most ironic things is that in the United States, I don't think there's a more thoroughgoing purveyor of conspiracy theories than Mr. Pipes, at least in the mainstream media. Every time anyone who has an Islamic religious affiliation or comes from the Middle East does anything wrong or commits some kind of crime and atrocity, he immediately becomes part of a jihadist plot. Mr. Pipes even linked the Washington, D.C. sniper shootings by this Malvo and Mr. Muhammad, which, I mean, there is no reason whatever except for the apparent conversion of one of these guys to the Nation of Islam, which is rather different than any mainstream version of Islam. You know, he said this was jihadist and bin Ladenite, and you know, this whole shooting spree was the result of radical Islamic thinking. And he's jumped to the same conclusion about the tragic fragging incident in Doha. And, you know, so, I mean, you know, if you take a look at his work, what you'll find is, you know, a strong element of conspiracy theorizing. So the ironies are endless. You know, man of war posing, you know, being put on an Institute of Peace, a character assassin who can't take any criticism, and a man who talks about the horrors of conspiracy theory, promoting endless conspiracy theory.
We are joined back on the line by Daniel Pipes of the Middle East Forum. Daniel Pipes, in terms of the ways you've characterized, for example, Hussein Ibish of the American Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee, how will you be promoting peace at the U.S. Institute of Peace?
I cannot talk about my nomination, and I cannot talk with someone who has come out against my nomination, which is why I got off the line before.
That's fine. You don't have to talk about that nomination, but why don't you talk about your work then? Talk about Campus Watch.
Campus Watch is an effort I began a half year ago. The critiques Middle East studies has been widely misportrayed as being about anti-Semitism or Israel or divestment. It's none of those things, nor is it McCarthyite. It's not an attempt to have anyone lose his job or suppress freedom of speech. It's an attempt to look at the field of Middle East studies from the point of view of myself and some colleagues, and we are saying that the actions, the statements, the analysis of the Middle East specialists, people with PhDs in Middle East studies, is faulty, is poor, is often wrong in its predictions, and that we have a series of complaints about this field and that we would like to see improvements made in it by the institutions that are sponsoring Middle East studies.
Hussein Ibish, can you respond to that?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think that is certainly the way Mr. Pipes has portrayed it.
Excuse me, I am not in a debate here. I thought I am one-on-one with you, Mr. Pipes. I am not in a debate with Ibish. I refuse to discuss anything with Mr. Ibish. I'm getting off the phone. I will not talk with someone who is a representative. I cannot deal with someone who has come out against me in my nomination.
But if...
I'm going to have to get off this phone because now for the second time I made it clear that I can only talk with a host. I'm not engaged in debate with someone who has come out against my nomination.
But we're having a discussion about the issues.
I cannot discuss.
Presumably in the future you'll have to talk with people who've been opposed to your positions.
I am not going to do that now. This is just not possible for me.
What about what you said in the National Post? Israel needs to take more active steps, bury suicide bombers in Potter's Fields rather than deliver their bodies to relatives, permit no transportation of people or goods beyond basic necessities, shut off utilities to the Palestinian Authority, raise the Palestinian Authority's illegal offices in Jerusalem at security infrastructure and villages from which attacks are launched.
Sounds to me like good ideas.
I didn't
actually promote them. I raised these as, I quoted others as saying these are ideas, and they seem to me reasonable ideas.
To raise a village?
I didn't say to raise the village.
It says to raise the PA's illegal offices in Jerusalem, its security infrastructure, and villages from which attacks are launched.
I believe that when a society is under assault, as we were on 9/11, and Israel is constantly, that society to take preventive steps. I don't think the Israelis have been, or at least at that time, that's a year or two old, had been taking the kind of steps they need to protect themselves.
presumably in all of your work, you, in fact, we've had you on a number of times where you do debate different people. Why are you limiting it right now, especially people that you yourself have criticized or attacked, to have a fair forum where you can each voice your opinions?
Because I'm under certain constraints as a nominee.
And who has nominated you to the U.S. Institute of Peace?
The president.
And what is the background to that nomination?
I cannot talk about the nomination. I don't know how clear I can be on this. I can't talk about it.
Well, you have said in the past that Muslims have no religious connection to Jerusalem.
I have not said that. I have a long article in which I argue that the Muslim interest in Jerusalem rises and falls depending on political circumstances. I did not say there's no religious connection. I've said that the political interest waxes and wanes depending on circumstances. And I look over a period of 1,400 years and establish that time and again.
Should ordinary Muslims in this country be surveilled?
Be what?
Be surveilled, monitored.
We have a situation in which we are being repeatedly attacked now for almost 25 years by the supporters of militant Islam, starting in 1979 and going on until the present. It makes little sense, as, for example, is the case at airline security, to look at non-Nigerians, at infants, at former presidential candidates, at airline pilots, to see if they might be carrying weapons to hijack the plane. One has to focus in on the population that is most likely to engage in such criminal activities. And given the pattern of hostilities against Americans, the fact is that most of these attempts at these criminal activities come from the supporters of militant Islam. Well, unfortunately, those supporters are limited almost exclusively to the Muslim community. It therefore makes sense to focus in on the likely suspects.
Is it racist?
Of course it's not racist. It has nothing to do with race whatsoever. It can be anyone of any race, any gender, any national origin, any ethnicity. Nothing to do with race. It has to do with support of a body of ideas, belief in a body of ideas. It has to do with militant Islam and aggression towards Americans.
Did you support, do you now, looking back on the internment of Japanese Americans during World War II?
It's not a subject I know enough about to talk about.
Well, thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
Okay, bye-bye. I'm sorry that Daniel Pipes has said he will not come have a discussion with people who disagree with him. Ibrahim Hooper, could you talk about your concerns?
This is a guy I'd want to be on the board of my Institute for Peace. Yeah. the guy, he's incredible. This is, I love his theory that he's only against militant Muslims, but it's a distinction without a difference. He loves Islam and moderate Muslims, but he just doesn't actually know any moderate Muslims. Everybody in his mind is a militant Muslim. I mean, it's very interesting. He has actually said that the enfranchisement of Muslims in America is a threat. And he's repeated this many times.
I think basically the message that comes out of Daniel Pipes, when you look at his work in aggregate, and when you put it also in the context of what other people who are also engaged in a similar project, including some of the evangelical leaders like Franklin Graham, Pat Robertson, Jerry Falwell, and others, the message that they send basically about American Muslims is a simple one, which is, you know, these people you may meet them in the street and they may seem nice and normal, but you've got to know that their values are completely antithetical to yours, that they represent a hostile and alien civilization and they worship a hostile and alien God, and that they're not here to live a good, decent American life, but to subvert and take over our nice, Western Judeo-Christian society and subvert it and destroy it. Now, what is interesting about that is it is precisely the same accusation that was made against American Jews in the teens and 20s by anti-Semites and, coming from similar quarters, indeed, like the religious right. I mean, Pat Robertson is the Father Coughlin of our era. But What is ironic is that now some Jewish Americans who are extreme right-wing supporters of Israel, like Daniel Pipes, have gotten into the same game. So, you know, in effect, Daniel Pipes is promoting what amounts to the moral equivalent of anti-Semitism. It's certainly intellectually indistinguishable from classical American anti-Semitism. And most of its tropes and arguments and its basic message are precisely the same. I think that really Mr. Pipes ultimately emerges as an extremely dangerous and disturbing figure, a purveyor of what amounts to, a slightly warmed over version of anti-Semitic impulses, you know. It's slightly different, but in substance, it's almost indistinguishable.
As we speak, I am watching the statue of Saddam Hussein fall in Baghdad. It was just pulled down, I think, with support of U.S. troops. Your thoughts on that? Let's start with Hussein Ibish.
I think that, you know, those of us who opposed the war and continue to oppose the war, which certainly includes the ADC and myself, need to be clear that, you know, the passing of Saddam Hussein from the Iraqi world scene is a good in and of itself. And, there is no reason not to be pleased to see the demolition of the megalomaniacal statues of a foul tyrant and the dismantling of the apparatus of a cult of personality. That is always a good thing. The question we have asked from the beginning is, at what cost is this coming? And will the Iraqi people truly be liberated or not?
Well, as you speak, with the Saddam Hussein statue being brought down by U.S. soldiers operating a crane, others, Iraqis, have put up an Iraqi flag. They're trying to put it on the podium of the pedestal that held the statue. Ibrahim Hooper, your response.
Nobody liked this vile tyrant. In fact, Muslims disliked him when he was still allied with the United States and shaking hands with Rumsfeld back in the 80s. He's killed so many Muslims you can't even count. But that wasn't the main question. The main question was, does the American government preemptively invade another country basically at the behest of a small group of ideologues who want to reorder the Middle East to benefit another country? And the vast majority of Muslims, while being opposed to Saddam Hussein, objected to that policy and still object to it. And we hope that once it's completely finished, the Iraqis will be left to determine their own future, free of American generals and generals who have signed pro-Israel letters to the government in the past, and guys like Woolsey who's calling for World War IV.
Ibrahim Hooper of the Council on American-Islamic Relations, Hussein Ibish of the American Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee, and Daniel Pipes of the Middle East Forum. That does it for today's program. Our website, democracynow.org. If you want a copy of today's show, call 1-800-881-2359. Democracy Now! Produced by Chris Abrams, Mike Burke, Angie Karenan, Noguera, Elizabeth Perez, Sharif Abdel Kadous, Mike DeFilippo, our engineer. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening. From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! An Israeli soldier has shot dead an Associated Press cameraman in Nablus. On Saturday, Naza Dawarza became the fourth journalist killed by Israeli troops since the Second Intifada began. We'll go to Nablus to speak with a Reuters photographer who witnessed the killing. And we'll celebrate Passover with our annual airing of a Jewish Seder that celebrates women and liberation. It was founded by Gloria Steinem and Bella Abzug. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. U.S. military officials have told the New York Times that the Pentagon intends to keep four bases in Iraq even after occupation forces leave. The Pentagon may maintain full operational bases in Iraq or just access to the bases in times of crisis. Officials claim this does not contradict the administration's official policy of rapid withdrawal from Iraq. The bases would pose a significant threat to neighboring Syria, and Iran would be sandwiched between U.S. bases in Iraq and Afghanistan. The past 2 years have seen a rapid expansion of the U.S. military across thousands of miles, stretching from the Balkans to the Chinese border and taking in the Caucasus, Central Asia, the Middle East, and the Indian subcontinent. The New York Times calls it a swath of Western influence not seen for generations. A former Iraqi scientist has told a U.S. military team that Iraq destroyed chemical weapons and biological warfare equipment only days before the invasion started. This according to an article in today's New York Times by Judith Miller. The scientist also said Iraq secretly sent unconventional weapons and technology to Syria starting in the mid-90s and that more recently Iraq was cooperating with al-Qaeda. And he led Americans to material that proved to be the building blocks for a toxic agent that's banned by chemical weapons treaties, or so says the New York Times. U.S. officials said it is the most important discovery to date in the hunt for illegal weapons. The Pentagon is refusing to identify the toxic agent or the name of the scientist. Reporter Judith Miller is embedded with the U.S. military and was not allowed to write about the scientist for 3 days. Her report was submitted to military officials for censorship. The report seems to accomplish everything the U.S. and British governments need. The Times article comes as British Prime Minister Tony Blair is facing increasing demands for an investigation into whether British intelligence services misled the government into believing Saddam Hussein was harboring weapons of mass destruction. Conservatives this weekend called Tony Blair on him, saying he has a moral obligation to investigate the issue. The British defense minister rejected the call and said it might take a long time to find any weapons. Britain is now suggesting an independent country should confirm any discovery of the weapons by British or U.S. troops. The New York Times reported on Saturday the Bush administration is planning to ask the United Nations to lift the sanctions against Iraq in phases. The UN would maintain its supervision of Iraqi oil sales for now. This comes after Russia, France, and other Security Council members made it clear they will not support the lifting of sanctions unless the UN is given a central role in rebuilding Iraq. The Times also reported some Bush administration officials fear a messy situation in which the U.S. or U.S.-occupied Iraq could be sued for selling oil in defiance of U.N. measures and in violation of international law. This appears to be the first evidence that the Bush administration had been considering selling Iraq's oil illegally before the sanctions are lifted. Also Saturday, the foreign ministers from the countries that share a border with Iraq met in Saudi Arabia for their first post-invasion summit. They all agreed to oppose the lifting of UN sanctions until a legitimate government in Iraq, formed by Iraqis, is in place. They said the U.S. has no right to exploit Iraq's oil and should pull out as soon as possible. They also called for a central post-invasion role for the United Nations. The Bush administration's temporary ruler of Iraq, retired American General Jay Garner, has arrived in Baghdad as confusion mounts over who is in control of the capital city. Meanwhile, the U.S. coordinator for Central Iraq, the ambassador to Yemen, Barbara Bodine, said today that Washington does not recognize Mohammed Mohsen al-Zubaydi as the mayor of Baghdad. Zubaydi is a longtime exile and deputy leader of the U.S.-backed Iraqi National Congress. Late last week, he announced he had been elected mayor of Baghdad, to the surprise of most residents. Modine's comments come after Zubaydi's deputy announced he'll lead an Iraqi delegation to a meeting of the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries, OPEC, starting on Thursday in Vienna. And the Financial Times reports the Iraqi oil ministry, ringed by U.S. tanks and guarded by U.S. soldiers, was paid a visit by a representative of Zubaydi. He said he represents the new coordinating committee for the oil ministry. Mohammed Mohsen al-Zubaydi also said over the weekend that Iraq's new constitution will be based on Islamic law. Less than 2 weeks after Saddam's government fell, thousands of his Ba'ath Party members are resuming their roles as men and women who run Iraq, this according to the Guardian of London. It has become increasingly apparent that Washington cannot restore governance to Baghdad without resorting to the party, which for decades controlled every aspect of life under the regime. 2,000 policemen, all card-holding party members, have put on their uniforms and returned to the streets of Baghdad at America's invitation. Dozens of minders from the Information Ministry, who spied on foreign journalists for the security agencies, have returned to the Palestine Hotel, where most reporters stay, offering their services as translators to unwitting new arrivals. Meanwhile, the Pentagon-backed Iraqi exile Ahmed Shalabi has called for U.S. troops to remain in Iraq until democratic elections can be held, which he said could take 2 years. And Senator Richard Lugar of Indiana, the Republican chair of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, said yesterday it could take at least 5 years to create a functioning democracy in Iraq. Tens of thousands of Shia worshippers are making their way towards the holy city of Karbala in the first pilgrimage allowed on Iraq's main highways for more than a decade. The pilgrims are making the journey to commemorate the anniversary of the death in battle of Hussein, a grandson of the Prophet Muhammad, in the year 680. The festival culminates with a mass gathering at Hussein's grave tomorrow and Wednesday and is of enormous religious significance to Shia Muslims. But it will be a show of force to the Americans as well. On Friday, Ayatollah Mohammed Bakr al-Hakim called on the people to converge on Karbala to express their opposition to foreign domination and their support for the establishment of a free and just government. The U.S. Army captain who commanded the tank that killed two journalists when it shelled the Palestine Hotel has contradicted the U.S. military's initial explanation for the attack. Captain Wolford told the French newspaper Nouvel Observateur that his forces had seen a glint of light reflecting off what they thought were binoculars on one of the hotel's balconies. He said his unit was under severe sniper and rocket fire from nearby buildings, and he assumed the binoculars were being held by whoever was directing the incoming sniper and rocket fire. Wolford's account contradicts the U.S. military's defense of its actions in the aftermath of the killings. The military claimed it was responding to sniper fire coming from the Palestine Hotel itself. Journalists immediately disagreed, saying they had heard no shooting at the time. U.S. Captain Wolford also said he'd never been told the Palestine Hotel was the home base for almost all the international journalists in Baghdad. He said he can't imagine orders to avoid the hotel could have gotten lost in the chain of command. The U.S. Army ignored warnings from its own civilian advisors that could have prevented the looting of Baghdad's National Museum. This according to leaked documents seen by the Observer of London. The Office of Reconstruction and Humanitarian Assistance, set up to supervise the rebuilding of post-invasion Iraq, identified Iraq's National Museum as a prime target for looters in a memo to Army commanders a month ago. The memo said it should be the second priority for the Army after securing the National Bank. General Jay Garner is said to be livid. One angry reconstruction official told the Observer, quote, "We asked for just a few soldiers at each building, or if they feared snipers, then just one or two tanks. The tanks were doing nothing once they got inside the city, yet the generals refused to deploy them." Two senior figures in the ousted Iraqi regime were captured over the weekend, including Saddam Hussein's son-in-law and one of his trusted inner circle, Jamal Mustafa Sultan Abdullah al-Tikriti. According to the Iraqi National Congress, Jamal Mustafa left Syria where he'd fled and surrendered to the INC in Baghdad. This news from China: the mayor of Beijing has been fired, as China is acknowledging over 100 more cases of the deadly SARS virus, including four in provinces previously thought free of the disease. The AFP reports the Minister of Health is likely to be sacked as well. Singapore's prime minister estimates SARS has already cost Singapore over $800 million. The World Health Organization and the U.S. Centers for Disease Control have advised all non-essential travel to Hong Kong, China, Singapore, and Hanoi be postponed, and several U.S. companies are restricting employee travel to the Far East. In Canada, public health officials fear they're losing control. The country has 247 suspected and probable cases, all stemming from a single elderly female traveler who returned from Hong Kong unaware of the virus she was harboring. Thousands of people in Toronto with flu-like symptoms have put themselves into voluntary quarantine, but officials know that other symptomatic patients are refusing to isolate themselves. India, Australia, and Malaysia are the latest nations to have suspected or probable cases. In the United States, health officials are investigating at least 193 cases in 32 states, including five in Virginia. The New York Times reports that scientists applying for federal grants to study AIDS are being told to cleanse their applications of politically sensitive words that refer to same-sex partnering or drug use. Speaking on condition of anonymity, an official at the National Institutes of Health said that while researchers had always been advised to avoid phrases that might be controversial, the level of scrutiny under the Bush administration is, quote, much worse and more intense. An Israeli soldier shot and killed an Associated Press cameraman in the West Bank city of Nablus on Saturday. We'll have more on that story in just a minute. Meanwhile, five Palestinians and an Israeli combat photographer were killed in an early morning tank and helicopter raid on the densely populated Rafah refugee camp in the southern Gaza Strip. One of those killed was a 14-year-old Palestinian boy. 30 others were injured. You are listening to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. An Israeli soldier shot and killed an Associated Press cameraman in the West Bank city of Nablus on Saturday. 45-year-old Naza Dawarza was filming Israeli troops firing on Palestinian youths throwing stones. Then an Israeli soldier pointed his gun at the journalists and fired. Dawarza was shot in the head. He and other cameramen covering the melee wore brightly colored vests that said "Press" in bold letters. Dawarza is the fourth journalist killed covering the Israel-Palestine conflict in the past year. All four were shot by Israeli soldiers. Dawarza had lived in Nablus all his life and worked for AP for the last 2 years. He's survived by his wife Raida and five children, ranging in age from 6 months to 9 years. The Israeli military has had no immediate comment, but said it's looking into the shooting. Meanwhile, in Gaza, five Palestinians and Israeli combat photographer were killed in an early morning tank and helicopter raid on the densely populated Rafah refugee camp. This came during one of Israel's largest attacks on Gaza since the Second Intifada began 30 months ago. We're joined right now by Abed Kusini, a Reuters photographer who was standing next to Naza Dewarza when he was shot. We welcome you to Democracy Now!, Abed Kusini.
Thanks, that welcome for you.
Thank you for joining us. Can you describe exactly what happened on Saturday in Nablus?
Exactly. Since the early morning of Saturday, there was a raid from the Israeli army to the old city of Nablus. We were covering that since the early morning. Me and Nazih Darwaza and the other friends. There were a lot of students here throwing stones at the Israeli tanks and jeep, and we were covering that. At the time, let's say, before 10 o'clock, we were in a narrow road where there are a lot of tens of youth throwing stones at the Israeli, two tanks and a jeep standing in the end of the road. We tried to get closer to the scene, to take closer pictures. We were four working with AP and Reuters trying to get closer. We were standing at the opposite side of the stone throwers. We haven't been at their side. If you are talking about the Israeli army, we are at their right, and the stone throwers are at the left side of the soldiers. Four of us were wearing vests, helmets, and yellow clothes, yellow vest with a big sign of press on it. And when we get closer, Nazih Darwaza was shouting in English and Hebrew, press, that to make the soldiers and also the stone throwers to know that the journalists are in this house. We were standing at the gate of the house taking pictures, and the soldiers were aiming their weapons toward the stone throwers. Suddenly, one soldier left his Hummer armored jeep and went down the tank and shot one bullet towards the right, toward our side. One bullet which hit Nazih Darwaza's head over his right eye, the eye in which he is looking inside his video camera. It broke the glasses and entered his skull, making his death immediately. I was just standing on his left. I with my right, which is inside the camera, I saw his camera going down, falling in the front. But some woman from the house shouted, the man fell down. I looked behind. I found him falling near my feet on the ground with his half of his head is broken and all of his brain on the ground. It was something, nightmare. We began screaming, crying at that moment. Our colleague died. I know that he's dying because no way. The scene that I have seen means that he's dead. No way to say more than it's something, you know, more emotional. Something like a nightmare in front of my eyes for my brother or colleague, which we have been together the last years, covering everything. We are not a part of the conflict. We are just taking these pictures to our agencies to show the world what's going on. We are not a part. We are not throwing stones. We are not gunmen. We are not soldiers. We are not a part of what's going on. And the soldier aimed his gun up towards us, and he killed our friend Nazih Darwaza, who left his children alone.
Abed Kusini, are you going to continue shooting pictures for Reuters?
You know, at the funeral, all my managers from Reuters and the other from AP, AFP, all they came to Nablus. My manager asked me, you want to continue? If you want to leave the work, you can do. You can take your money and leave the job. You can do. Because he saw me on the channels, on the TV, screaming. He asked me if you want to leave. But, you know, it is a shock for some days. But then we will carry the cameras again. We have seen others before. In Baghdad, we have seen guys from Reuters, from Al Jazeera who were killed. And we have seen in the West Bank, cameramen and photo killed. It is a shock of, and we will calm down then to go back. We are crazy, you know. Our job is a crazy job. I have a bad situation in my family, my wife, my kids, my mother. They are calling me to look for a job or you know, there are fears for tomorrow. You know, we were surprised more with the Israeli army who say there were gunfire or we are not sure from where the bullet came. Something crazy, and no one than them in the field, and they are shooting. So we are concerned of tomorrow. We are calling all the journalists association in the world to look of this to put pressure on the Israeli army to say, I expect the Israeli army to say, you are sorry, we were mistaken, but to say we did not do that. That's the most crazy thing. So we are afraid, and our families are afraid for tomorrow. Maybe Nazif for today, maybe I will be tomorrow or the others. But at the end, me myself, you know, it's our life, and I will carry the camera. Just I need a couple of weeks, maybe to go out of the country to get rest, and then I'll carry the camera again and shoot pictures.
What were Naza Dawarza's thoughts about filming the Intifada, about filming in Nablus and other places, given that, well, at that point, three other journalists had been killed by the Israeli troops since the second Intifada began?
Yeah, he's covering with us since the beginning. He's with us the last 2 years. He's covering day by day the incursions, the clashes going on in Nablus. You know, he was with us in the last 2 years, all the time. You know, we see each other more than we see our wives or our kids. Like, you know, the other family for me is the generals.
We're talking to Abed Kusini in Nablus. I wanted to read you the New York Times account and ask if you think this is accurate, describing more than 30 Israeli tanks and armored personnel carriers backed by attack helicopters roaring into the southern Gaza Strip in a nighttime raid directed at Palestinian militants, but that earlier on Saturday in the West Bank, they describe a Palestinian cameraman shot dead by an Israeli soldier while filming violence in Nablus. At the end of the piece, when Israeli troops responded by firing, it says, as the troops were pulling out, a tank hit a curb and became stuck, and large numbers of Palestinians began throwing stones and firebombs, with some firing guns at the stranded vehicle. This according to an Israeli major. When Israeli troops responded by firing rifles, the youths ran for cover in the alleys and narrow side streets. Video footage taken by Reuters shows a soldier kneeling beside the tank and pointing a rifle down the alley where the journalists were wearing fluorescent green bulletproof vests that read press. A moment later, Mr. Dawarza was hit and fell to the ground. Is that your recollection of what happened, Abed Kusini?
Yeah, but the point that there is no gunfire in the area. At the point we have been, before half an hour, we saw gunmen in other streets shoot at the Israeli army. But I'm talking at that point, we mustn't mix between an hour before and an hour after. At that point, at that street, there were tens of stone throwers throwing just stones, even no bombs, stones, but they were too close to the tanks and jeeps throwing the stones. And the soldiers were inside their tanks and jeep, and one soldier left the Hummer jeep and kneeled down the tank and began shooting. Many youths were wounded, and we were filming at that minute, wounded, being carried by paramedics to the ambulance at that point, when the soldier aimed his weapon to the right side of the narrow road and shot one bullet, which hit Nazir Dawarza. This is the 100%
You were wearing green, fluorescent green bulletproof vests that said press?
Yeah. We, all of us, and over that, over the vest, we're wearing yellow phosphoric color, which you can see even at night. Mm-hmm. But when he was hit in the eye, there is no protection on the eye, even if he has a helmet or, you know, the face is a bit.
Do you feel that the Israeli military is targeting journalists? And do you feel, as a Palestinian journalist, you have less protection?
Yeah, of course, I have less protection. In the last 2 years, we have bad experience with the Israeli army, that they are dealing with us as Palestinians in the curfew and in the bad situation. They stop us. They don't stop the foreigner. They say you are Palestinians before you are journalists. And when I gave them my Reuters ID, he asked me for the Palestinian ID. He said, you are Nablus guy. You are under curfew. You are Palestinian before journalists. They say always no immunity for Palestinian journalists. They are journalists. I have been arrested for a couple of days before, and they said to Reuters, to AP, he will be investigated. If he's clear, he will go. He's a Palestinian. So that's the big problem. Of course, we are concerned about tomorrow. We're concerned about the way that the Israeli army has no exact rules. It depends on the nervous of the soldier or the officer on the street. He can make his decision on the ground. He does not have rules to deal with us. And that's the most problem we fear, that the soldier can decide even to shoot, to arrest, to punish, to break the equipment, or to do whatever.
Abed Kusini, earlier we reported 4 journalists had been killed in the last 2 years, but now looking at Haaretz, the Israeli newspaper, it says the IDF has killed 7 journalists, 6 Palestinians and 1 Italian in the past 2 years in the territories, and that demonstrations protesting the IDF shooting of Naza Dewarza were held in Ramallah and Bethlehem. The demonstrators covering their mouths with black cloth, symbolizing the gagging of the media, and the Foreign Press Association in Israel calling for a comprehensive investigation into Dewarza's shooting. What kind of solidarity is being expressed by Israeli journalists now as Mr. Dewarza has just been buried?
I think they are doing well. Since the morning they were calling us, many Israeli journalists were calling us, taking more details, and they will stop in front of the army because they will be heard more than us with the defense ministry or the government, because they are Israelis. They promised us that they will stop in front of them and they will ask for more details for investigation and to put the punishment and on the soldiers. They must find the soldiers who shot, not to leave it like we are sorry or we don't know from the bullets. They will help a lot, I think. And yesterday we have a Knesset member, Arab Knesset member, who visited us in Nablus, Mohammed Baraka, and he promised to talk about that in the Knesset and to work to investigate the issue. And you know, we are working with all the people in the world, with agencies, with organizations of journalists. We must make this issue very big, and maybe it will be, try to make it the end. We have 4 or 7 were killed, whatever, but we hope he will be the last. And to make the Israelis think more about the journalist who is working in front of them, that he is covering, he's not a part of the conflict, he's covering whatever. We the journalists, we are thinking about new rules for us in working. Like, we don't want to go to clashes, we will not to cover this and to wait. If there is a funeral, to go to the funeral, some civil demonstration to go, but not to go. We were talking today that to have new rules in covering what's going on, because I want to stay with my family. I don't like to take pictures and die or move. This salary better than to be went or died or jailed or whatever from the Israeli side.
That last sentence, we just missed it. Sorry.
What?
I didn't hear your last sentence.
Yeah, what I said, that, you know, to have less salary, less money, to cover half of the events in the West Bank, better than to cover everything and to be wounded or jailed or killed and lose my family.
Abed Kusini, I want to thank you for being with us and all of our condolences here at Democracy Now! And Pacifica to your friend and colleague, Naza Dewarza. Finally, how old was he?
He's 43.
43 years old.
Yeah.
Abed Kusini is speaking to us from Nablus. You are listening to Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute. Oh, You are listening to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report, Breaking the Sound Barrier. I'm Amy Goodman. This weekend, the New York Times reported that the Bush administration is planning to ask the United Nations to lift the sanctions against Iraq in phases. The UN would maintain its supervision of Iraqi oil sales for now. This comes after Russia, France, and other Security Council members made it clear they will not support the lifting of sanctions unless the UN is given a central role in rebuilding Iraq. The Times also reported some Bush administration officials fear a messy situation in which the U.S. or U.S.-occupied Iraq could be sued for selling oil in defiance of U.N. measures and in violation of international law. This appears to be the first evidence that the Bush administration had been considering selling Iraq's oil illegally before the sanctions are lifted. We're joined right now by Dennis Halliday. He's the former Assistant Secretary General of the United Nations, was the head of the Oil for Food program in Iraq until he quit over the sanctions regime. Welcome to Democracy Now! Once again,
Dennis.
Thanks, Amy. What are your thoughts about this? What exactly is the U.S. doing?
Well, strangely, perhaps coming from me, I agree with Mr. Bush. Let's lift those sanctions psychologically and physically. They have damaged the Iraqi people for 12 and a half years. They deny Iraq the full revenue of oil sales. Under the UN sanctions, Iraq receives less than 70% of oil revenues. Under Mr. Bush's plan, it would be 100%. Now, I know he's got a hidden agenda. I know it's about control, it's about oil, it's about perhaps a number of other things. But I think we've got to move forward, end the sanctions, and to see France, Russia, and China again playing games with the people of Iraq and their lives, I think is disgusting. I think we've got to move forward. The UN, in my view, has a very limited role in Iraq. I think it's an interim role. They've got their hands on the resources of Iraq right now. They should finish those contracts and get food delivered to Iraq and let the distribution system take over within the country.
What about this idea that the reason the U.S. wants to lift the sanctions and comply with calls of people for the last 12 years to end the sanctions regime, it's simply so that they would be able to sell the oil?
Well, the interim government of Iraq will ultimately sell the oil, and there is a gap here. We've got a problem, I suppose. But, you know, I don't think the U.N. coming in some interim government system is the answer to that. That would mean delay. And you have to remember the U.N. is extremely unpopular in Iraq. The U.N. is associated with the loss of over a million lives under U.N. sanctions. So nobody wants the U.N. back in Iraq in a political sense. The U.S. is perhaps a better option in the short run. And I mean, you know, 3, 6, 9 months, we should see an interim government in charge. They must have access to the full revenue of oil sales and be in control of oil sales. I mean, that's the way I think we've got to move forward. We don't need three steps. We can go from now an interim American program under this man, Jay Garner, and then move into, I think, full Iraqi control.
Mm-hmm. You have now Mohammed Mohsen al-Zubaydi, who has said he is the mayor of Iraq, longtime exile, deputy leader of the U.S.-backed Iraqi National Congress, who says he will lead a delegation to OPEC in Vienna.
Well, I don't know who this man is. I think anybody coming in from overseas like Chalabi after 45 years just is not going to be taken seriously within Iraq. There's a very viable community in Iraq, both within the Shia and Sunni communities. They are going to lead this country. And we've seen something happening which is very interesting. We see Iraqis in the streets. The leadership is coming from the imams, the Shia imams. And this is the way it may turn out to be. And Mr. Bush may be in for a surprise. We may get a democracy, but it'll be, I think, an Islamic democracy, perhaps along the Iranian model or perhaps the Turkish model. This is the way it may go. If that's what the people of Iraq want, you know, who's going to argue against that?
Now, you've been traveling around the world speaking out against the invasion. Where have you most recently come from?
Well, I've been recently in Cairo, in Jordan, in North Africa. And, of course, I was in Iraq in January, where I, you know, visited with families and with officials and saw the Oil for Food program delivering foods, which is still happily in the hands of most Iraqi families as we speak.
Mm-hmm. And what has been the response there during the invasion?
Well, it's quite fascinating. I thought the Iraqis would be a bit more patient and be more tolerant of the U.S. invasion. But it's seeming that within 1 week, there's now a very large request that the United States occupation forces leave, and that nobody seems to want to wait much longer than that. Mr. Chalabi, I can see, has been caught between his friends in the Pentagon and local pressures. But it seems quite clear the Iraqis can do it themselves. I mean, I know that from experience. They have technocrats and others who are really skilled people. They can make this country work. They don't need Jay Gardner. They don't need the United Nations. They need to be allowed to run this country and then draw on the international community as they see fit. I mean, this is their country. It's their right. They have been suppressed by a very tough regime for many years, plus UN sanctions and interference by the rest of us overseas. They must be allowed to go it alone with our assistance if they wish that assistance.
Richard Lugar, the Republican senator who heads the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, said yesterday it could take at least 5 years to create a functioning democracy in Iraq.
Well, I think that's a vested interest speaking. He obviously wants to see American control. We heard yesterday about American bases. We've seen huge corruption already in the sense of, well, in Washington, I guess we're used to that. Now, of course, corporate America seems to be getting its hands on Iraq. The Bechtel Group is going to make a fortune. That, I suppose, was to be expected. I don't think the Iraqis are going to tolerate this. They're not going to see their money spent on current contracts in which they have no role. They're going to demand what they believe is necessary. I think we're in for a very difficult period, but the Iraqis will win out, in my view, and the United States was going to have to curb its ambitions quite severely.
And do you think they will?
I think they'll have no choice, because the Iraqis are not a disorganized group like those in Afghanistan. This is a very strong, rich country, with great people, well-trained, largely in the United States, Britain and France. They know what they want. They have the capacity to go and get it. They've run a country under difficult circumstances now for, what, almost 13 years. They've staved off starvation with the Oil for Food program. They know what they're about. Just give them a chance, an opportunity, and they can do it themselves. They don't need the rest of us, apart from our perhaps capital investment and our support, and support from good NGOs and some of the UN agencies in the short run.
Well, Dennis Halliday, I want to thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Dennis Halliday, former assistant UN Secretary General with the UN for more than 30 years before he quit protesting the UN sanctions regime imposed on Iraq. You are listening to Democracy Now! When we come back, a special Passover Seder that is run by women. Stay with us. You are listening to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. This week is Passover, celebrated by Jews around the world. It's an eight-day holiday that remembers the liberation from slavery of Jews from ancient Egypt. Traditionally, on the first two nights of Passover, Jewish families hold dinners or seders where friends and family gather. Years ago, I went to an unusual Seder in New York City. It was a tradition begun in 1976 by Gloria Steinem and Jewish feminist writers Esther Broner and Phyllis Chesler. It was a unique Passover dinner celebrating women and liberation. Even 12 years ago, these women were voicing their opposition to the Israeli occupation. Esther Broner officiates. She wrote The Telling and the Women's Haggadah.
It's 6 o'clock. Women are arriving. In the dining room, there's no table, just two large sheets spread on the floor. Sheets covered with candles and one candelabra of little clay people with their arms reaching upward. You can put candles in each little hand. The women bring wine and dishes of food to share and put them in the living room for later. For now, aromas waft through the apartment. After a while, as more than 20 women fill the rooms, mothers and daughters and friends, Esther Broner calls the Seder to order. Actually, Seder means order, and the book that contains the ritual prayers and stories is called the Haggadah, Hebrew for the telling. Esther began writing her version of the Haggadah 16 years ago.
Welcome. This is our 16th Seder. This is the 16th time we've gathered together during the month of Nisan. Our reading in the synagogue this month was Leviticus, the listing of sacrifices. It makes me wonder what we as feminists sacrifice to gain a kind of spirituality, a closeness to holiness, or how we define holiness. So sacrifice is much on my mind. And war was the theme we settled on, and plagues we live under. For some of us, the war is not over. As a feminist, after reading Leviticus, as one of the tribe of Levi, the psalm writer, the singer at the temple, like Miriam, I would sacrifice. And first of all, patriotism from Patri, the father, the fatherland. So this is
how... When did you write this, Haggadah?
1976, but we revise it every year. Each year, the people around bring new ideas to it. So every one of the Seders for the last 16 years has been different.
What happened in 1976 that you did this?
We declared the Seder of the North, I and three friends, one in Knesset, Marcia Friedman, a social worker named Naomi Nimrod, and I. I was teaching in Haifa, Israel then. And we no longer wanted to serve. We no longer wanted to cook. We wanted to meditate. So we declared the men the cooks and the cleaners and the servers and the women the meditators. And we wrote new prayers that ultimately became this Haggadah. And the men were not altogether happy, but it began something quite radical. And then Naomi and I spent the rest of the spring term. I was teaching in Haifa, and she was actually attending my class, as was Marshall when she came in from Knesset. And I spent the rest of the spring term writing that. Every day we went and met, and we wrote it in her late father's study. He was a cantor, and Naomi was really nervous that we were doing something desecrating. Ultimately, we were so angry with what we discovered as we began reading about the Exodus and the women, about male attitudes towards women, that we knew that we had to make our own Exodus, and that's what happened in 76. So it was that long ago, and Ms. published in April of 77 about a third of it, which people still kill for.
What do you mean that the Exodus was only men?
Well, you read who left Egypt each time. Maybe there was one woman who left. And even when Miriam crossed the sea, she sang the same song that Moses did. She never had her own words. So by and large, the Exodus was the history of men. And it took five women to rescue Moses. It never tells about how many women it takes to rescue a woman and to make her a leader. So we felt it was a kind of paradigm that we could work with, and it turned out it had a lot of effect. To my enormous surprise, it was very popular, even in the Xeroxed form. Even Pioneer, Hadassah, Naamat women used it. Your most traditional of women were enraged by what they felt was the cleaning, which I'm now in the process of doing, the cleaning of the cupboards, the changing of dishes, ultimately the serving. And what your big worry is to keep the meal hot. And it seems to me that religion doesn't have anything to do with hot meals. Of meditation, of planning, of being together. But it is not the traditional sweet 16. We gather in strength of our 16th year, determined not to be sweet or nice Jewish girls, but to meet constantly, subversively, insistently, and to invite, to honor those left out of the Seder, our foremothers, our singer Miriam, and to give her new songs, not war songs, but songs of crossing the sea, songs of the timbrel, songs of marching into the unknown, and with the women, with the strength, saving one's people.
Man hazeh ruchat yashinatenu mekor habracha shehechianu vekimanu vehigianu lasman hazeh.
Became a it spread between us, the sisters, and more people came into it. We now have 7 of us who make it, 3 of us who sort of inspire it, Bella and Gloria, who wasn't able to be here today, and Grace Paley. And each year we invite a new person. Each of us invites usually one new person, sometimes more, hoping that they will go forth like little cells, form their own feminist satyrs, and learn to reshape religion. So what we're going to do is introduce ourselves by our matrilineage, our mothers, our grandmothers, our great-grandmothers, and by our new matriarchs. So let's go, let's see, we'll start to the left.
I'm not quite sure I know what you mean by a new matriarch. You mean somebody I choose to be a matriarch?
Yes.
Does it have to be alive or dead?
No, either one. It should be either one.
Well, since Bella isn't here, it'll be Bella Abzug.
That's all I said.
I'm Jenny Leia Zlata, and my mother is Michelle next to me. My grandmother, Nachama Leia, and my great-grandmother, Zlata. And
I'm Michelle Michal Bat Nachama Leia Bat Zlata. And let's make Gloria another of our matriarchs.
I'm Naomi, but Dvora, but Faye, but Mrs. Grandma. I'd like to choose Rosa Luxemburg as my matriarch because she was an activist who wrote lots of love letters. Lisa, but Diva, but Esther, but Chayasura. And if I can choose non-Jews and non-humans, I'm choosing Jane Goodall and Flo, the old matriarchal chimp, as my matriarch.
My name is Mel, my mother is Ruth, and my grandmother is Catherine, and I'm still searching for my matriarchs.
Mother of Nechama, daughter of Beatrice, daughter of Nechama, sister of Sivia, my other grandmother. I think my matriarchs are the women who are working for peace. From the WIMPs here on the west side, women indicting military plans and solutions, to the women in black who have not really been able to stand on their corners in the towns of Jerusalem, I think since the war began. And I would like instruction in times of peace, how to continue fighting, and in terms of war, how to look towards peace from them.
And from the uncertainty of questions to the certainty of ritual, the blessing of the candles by mother and daughter, Letty and Robin Pogrebin. And then to the annual repetition of the 4 questions. Traditionally, why is this night different from all other nights? Why do we eat matzah, bitter herbs? Why do we recline while eating? But at this Seder, at Robin's apartment, one of the daughters of the original Seder sisters, the questions were slightly different. They were asked by Jenny Landsberg and answered by her mother, Michelle.
Why is this Seder different from all other Seders? And why do we still feel the need to create a feminist Seder?
Because though it's 15 years since our rabbis, Phyllis and Esther, created a Seder that celebrated the exodus of women, we are still like a lost tribe. Men still want to sing solo at the Seder, in the Knesset, in the synagogue, and at the wall. Men still insist on making laws that govern women's wombs. While men still seek to silence our voices, Miriam's daughters must sing sweeter, bolder, louder.
But next year in Jerusalem, will women rejoice in the Torah at the Western Wall? Will all people pray in equal dignity together? Will the daughters of Pharaoh's daughters join us in the dance?
Our hope and courage.
And to the Litany of Dainu, the English translation, It Would Have Been Enough for Us. The song traditionally addresses God and is about abundance. Each verse recounts another thing God did for the Jewish people to liberate them from Egypt. And each verse ends with the word Dainu. Just one deed would have been enough. The Women's Dainu addresses society and is about scarcity. How women's role in Jewish liberation was scarcely recognized. Each verse recounts one woman's achievement and says, if just that had been acknowledged, it would have been enough.
If Papa had been created in the image of God and not as a helper to Adam, Dainu.
If she had been created as Adam's equal and not been considered a temptress, it would have sufficed.
If she were the first woman to eat from the tree of knowledge and had been recognized as bringing knowledge to us, Dainu.
If Lot's wife had been honored for compassion and looking back at the fate of her family in Sodom and had not been punished for it, Dainu.
If our mothers had been honored for their daughters as well as for their sons, Dainu.
If our mothers had not been considered as hardened roots or as fruit-bearing wombs, but as women in themselves, Dainu.
If the just women in Egypt who caused our redemption had been given sufficient recognition, Dainu.
If Miriam were given her seat with Moses and Aaron in our legacy, Dainu.
If women had written the Haggadah and placed our mothers where they belonged in history, Dainu.
If every generation of women, together with every generation of men, would continue to go out of Egypt, Dainu, Dainu.
Seder and that your women's Haggadah changed over the years. You say you've added things to it. I mean, themes, for example, this year.
We've had the same spine. We go through the same material because in the best traditional sense of revision, it's based upon the traditional Haggadah, the telling. But some years we declare a Kabbalistic year. Maybe we meditate and think about the number 9. Some years we try to think about what is it that upsets us with each other? Why aren't we working well together? And we have an intergroup mediation. Some years we've talked of losses. 2 years ago, the daughters took it and asked the mothers questions. And it was just deeply moving, probably the best Seder we ever had.
And so this year, the women talked about plagues, some internal and some external.
My plague is a sense of incompleteness. As a feminist, I'm very successful in my career, as in a man's career, by the way. And as a Jew, I feel that I'm successful in the sense that I've gotten married and starting a family, which is another sort of male world. But I feel that what I'm not successful at and I'm incomplete at is in the world of women, that all the women my generation were so busy with our careers and our families and trying to juggle both that we've forgotten about each other and that we don't have time for each other. And for me, that's a great loss.
My plague is focused at this moment on my deep alienation from my own people and Israel, and I have never felt that more strongly. My whole young life was structured around the idealism of a collective Zionism, and bit by bit it's been torn apart. And I now feel as though a Red Sea has rushed in, an angry tide between me and Israel. And I see on the far shore a people marching. Their Moses is, I see as a dwarfish Moses screaming, force, might, beatings. And I will never be reconciled, and I will never be reconciled to the pain of being so estranged from my own people. And
did it ever, in your frustration in 1976 and before, did you ever think, just throw the whole thing out, create whole new traditions?
I, I know the deep feeling of spirituality that women have. I'm very sympathetic to earth religions and seasonal religions, and I'm totally unsympathetic to a hierarchical religion where you bend your back looking up at a god. But the women I'm with, and Benoit Aish and other women, sort of work on the edges, trying to incorporate some of the past and trying to find a religion where the creative spirit comes from within rather than above.
Esther Broner hopes someday to publish the Women's Haggadah along with a history of the feminist Seder so that women will be passed over no more. For WBAI News, I'm Amy Goodman, daughter of Dorothy, granddaughter of Sonia and Gittel, great-granddaughter of Nahama, Gita, Ripka, great-great-granddaughter.
And today I dedicate the program to my grandmother, Sonia Bach, Sonyachka Shochet Bakalchuk, when she came to Ellis Island. Passover is also her birthday. She is 106 years old. If people want to get a video or audio cassette copy of today's program, you can call 1-800-881-2359. That's 1-800-881-2359. You can also go to our website at www.democracynow.org. You can email us at mail, M-A-I-L, at democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced by Chris Abrams, Mike Burke, Angie Karen, Anna Noguera, Elizabeth Press, also Noah Reibel and Sharif Abdel Kadous. Mike DeFilippo is our engineer. Special thanks to Uri Gallet, Angela Alston, Emily Kunstler, Johnny Sender, Orlando Richards, Raphael Deluz. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening.
All the bombs and guns to defend your holy empire. There are children hungry, children sick and...